Hello and welcome to this week's Road Less Traveled with Gary L. and Gigi's Boo. Merry Christmas. Hello, Gigi's Boo. Are you there?
I'm here. Merry Christmas, everybody.
Yeah. Yes, it's we thought we would start, originally thought we'd start later because of some commitments, but those commitments got switched around like so many things do, and we were able to stick with the normal time frame. And we appreciate you joining us. There's Grim Nears. A little bit of a lag time. That's okay. He's hearing the drums now, according to the chat room. So what have you been up to, Gigi's Boo?
Nothing but just opening my presents.
Open your Christmas, Bubba.
Yes. Yes, yes, yes.
Well, did you get something, some new equipment?
Yes, I did. I have a new pair of earphones from you.
New headset.
New headset. It's very, very nice. And from what everybody said, it sounds very nice, too.
Sounds good on this end. I'll let the chat room be the judge. Everybody hears things a little bit differently. Hard to hear over those drums. Oh, no. But I'll tell you what. No, let's not do that.
No, stop that.
Well, Atticus got a box.
I told you we were going to have some lag. We got some lag time tonight.
Yeah, it's a commendators, maybe, something like that. That's okay. So Atticus got a new box of organic dog biscuits. Oh, no.
Made out of peanut butter. And he loves them. He's been back here, I don't know how many times, begging, and I won't give them.
Yeah.
He would sit in a whole bag if I would let him have them.
Yeah, he saw those organic dog biscuits, ran and got him a headband and some round sunglasses he put on. He's got a little neck chain, too. He's a piece with a peace sign on it.
Yeah, he's Mr. Boombastic.
Yes, Mr. Boombastic. So, Merry Christmas to everyone. Merry Christmas to the chat room. And look, Barman is at the top of the list. How did that happen? Usually, that's not usually the case. But let's see. Got Beth Z showing up. Cowboy Tech, he's here. I saw him commenting in the chat room. Grimnir, and he's here. He heard the drums. And Moose Girl, I haven't seen her comment yet. Kate, and a PB New Year. Not sure who that is. He just said something. Who is and a PB, a peanut butter New Year? I guess it is. Chalcedony, Circolo, and he's, let's see, he's in Europe, actually. Gigi's Boo, if you didn't know that.
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah, Chloe is here two times, and Flash Tard, we know who that is. Graham Z, hello, Graham. Ibi Don C is here. And Java Doctor, Juana Taco. I try to get ahead of myself. Asmobe, there's Behind the Woodshed. Hal, I haven't seen him say anything yet, so he's probably still trying to get his blogcaster updated.
Yeah, we would say he's probably whooping nice.
It could be. Colfax Dakota, Gigi's Boo is here. J Dread, Yehovah, Kozu, Mbot, Quasimoto. It's Asmo's birthday today. What's up with that? Asmo, I thought we stopped having birthdays. Rain is here, RLM 174 and RLM 84597 is here. Rob Works, hello, Sock Puppet and the Phantom. All here on Christmas Day. As usual, anyone wants to call in on Skype, they can do so. On the old Pegasus 6 and the numbers 870, spell out Pegasus 6, and 870. It's the O instead of the 0 being used. Okay. Alrighty then. So you can call in and tell us about your Christmas experiences and anything you'd like. Gigi's Boo, how was your day?
It's been very good. Very quiet, but very good. One of those good days, you know?
Yeah,
just kind of quiet the whole nine yards.
Yeah, quiet days are good any day of the year.
You better believe that.
Yeah, it's true. It's not exactly snowy Christmas weather in this part of the world.
70 degrees today? I would think not.
No, I don't know. I think probably Grim Air probably had some. I don't know if he did or not, because I think he has some unusual weather out his way. He'll have to report in. Moose Girl, as I noticed, I don't know what it's been lately, but it's been in the below freezing by a significant amount in Wisconsin. So maybe they had some seasonal Christmas weather. Very possible. And speaking of which, we did have a special show tonight. And there are three stories that we're going to relate and maybe speak to a little bit. There's Tom. Hello, Tom. Thanks for stopping by. That's Tom from one of my Facebook friends. He finally got in listening to a show. Very nice fellow. But we're going to examine the likelihood of miracles, and particularly Christmas miracles. Gigi's, what are your thoughts about miracles?
Miracles happen. I'm a firm believer in them.
Yeah.
So many things. I mean, you know, people have given up on things like that. But I'm one that still believes that they happen. And they do.
Yeah.
Every day.
And the three stories that we have to share,
mm-hmm.
I think, give some measure of proof to that idea. So if you want to, Gigi's Boot, we can start out with the first one. Is that okay, or did you have something else?
That's fine.
Okay.
Yeah, let's do that.
All right. Well, let's kick off the first one here. And it's somebody you'll recognize. And he's going to tell us a story about something that happened in World War I. Okay, enjoy. We'll be back in just a few minutes.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome once again Walter Cronkite. The story that you are about to hear is a true story. The faces that you will see are the faces of the families of the choir and orchestra. The 1900s, the final century of the recent millennium, brought unprecedented possibilities and promise. The children of these 100 years would see more improvement in the human condition than ever before in the world's history. Advances in medicine, science, and industry would all but eradicate disease, extend human life, open a dialogue among the peoples of the earth, and lift them into the vast reaches of space. But these hardly seem like possibilities as the Christmas of 1914 drew near. The nations of Europe were at war. Anxious to expand and defend their borders, they summoned their best and brightest to the battlefront. Young men answered by the millions. A 19-year-old German boy left his job in London to enlist in the German army. English boys working and studying in Hamburg and Paris returned to London, put on their uniforms, and went back to fire upon former friends. Secretary of War Lord Kitchener expanded the British Army overnight by allowing schoolmates to enlist together. The tragedy of these battalions was no more evident than at Somme, France. Hundreds of villages on both sides lost almost all of their young men in a single battle. The little paybook that every British soldier carried included a last will and testament, and thousands of these booklets were collected from the bodies of young boys, many reading simply, "I leave everything to my mother." With hardly a backward glance, the promise of youth was poured into the blind and futile aggression known as the Great War, World War I. The new century brought a new kind of warfare. Field commanders quickly realized that digging in was the only way to survive the sweep of machine gun fire. The German army had marched across Belgium before being stopped at Flanders Field. Some 60 yards away, British, French, and Belgian troops languished in tent trenches infested with rats and lice, pelted with freezing rain and shrapnel. As temperatures dropped, disease took hold. Snipers picked off those who raised their heads above those earthen walls. The war was but 4 months old, each side losing thousands a day, both to bullets and that silent common enemy, influenza. Between the opposing trenches was an area about the width of a football field, no man's land, littered with barbed wire and frozen corpses. It was a sobering reminder of what the future might bring. Soldiers who survived later recalled their brothers being gathered up and stacked like cords of wood. By war's end, more than 10 million would be lost. Not surprisingly, given the circumstances, most of the soldiers were religious and many were Christian. On Sundays, communion was passed in trenches on both sides, often to the sound of church bells ringing in nearby villages. The occasional hymn was sung, and youthful voices were heard across enemy lines. By December, the war slowed, and hopes for a quick resolution faded away. As the soldiers contemplated their desperate situation, nights grew long and hearts yearned for peace. December 23rd, a group of German soldiers quietly moved to the ruins of a bombed-out monastery. There, they held their first Christmas service. Later on that night, a few Christmas trees, Tannenbaums as they were called, began to appear along the German fortifications, their tiny candles flickering in the night. Across the way, British soldiers took an interest in those lights as they sang together the carols of their youth. Word spread, and heads peeked cautiously over sandbags at the now thousands of Tannenbaums glowing like Christmas stars. Two British officers ventured over to the German line and, against orders, arranged a Christmas truce. But the negotiation was a mere formality by then. Up and down the trenches, men from both sides already had begun crossing the line to join in the celebration. Lieutenant Sir Edward Hulse assaulted the enemy with music. In a letter to his mother, he wrote, "We're going to give the enemy every conceivable song, from carols to Tipperary." The Germans responded with a Christmas concert of their own. It was not long before the cold air rang with everything from "Good King Wenceslas" to "Auld Lang Syne."
Thank you.
next 2 days, those tidings continue to spring from the hearts of common men who shared the common bond of Christmas. Further down the line, a German violinist stood atop his parapet, framed against the skeletons of bare trees and shattered fortifications, and delicately perched in this desolate landscape, his cold fingers conveyed the poignant beauty of Handel's Largo. Whatever the spirit of Christmas had been before that hour, it was now, above all, the spirit of hope, of peace. A British war correspondent reported that later the soldiers heard a clear voice singing the beloved French carol, O Holy Night. The singer, Victor Granier of the Paris Opera. The night watch must have lifted their eyes toward the heavens as they heard his plaintive call. Christmas Day dawned over the muddy fields, and both sides cautiously picked their way through the barbed wire. Side by side, they buried their dead. A German officer known only as Thomas gave Lieutenant Hulse a Christmas gift, a Victoria Cross and letter, which had belonged to an English captain. Lieutenant Hulse responded by giving the German officer his silk scarf. One German retrieved a photograph of himself in uniform and asked his former enemies to post it to his sister in Liverpool. Men who had shot at each other only days before gathered in a sacred service for their fallen brothers. Prayers were offered, and the 23rd Psalm was read.
The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. He maketh me to lie down in green pastures. He leadeth me beside the still waters. He restoreth my soul. He leadeth me in the paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for thou art with me. Thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me. Thou preparest a table before me in the presence of mine enemies. Thou anointest my head with oil, and my cup runneth over. Surely goodness and mercy will follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever.
Thank you.
19-year-old Arthur Pelham Byrne, who hoped to study for the ministry after the war, remembered the Germans formed up on one side, the English on the other, the officers standing in front, every head bared. Yes, I think it is a sight one will never see again. As the Christmas of 1914 drew to a close, soldiers who had sung together, played together, and prayed together returned to their trenches. They must have felt reluctant to let the common ground between them become no man's land again. But even as the darkness fell around them, a lone voice floated across the few yards of earth on which they had stood together. In the true spirit of Christmas, one voice and then another joined in. Soon the whole world seemed to be singing, and for a brief moment, the sound of peace was a carol every soul knew by heart. That's the way it was one Christmas almost 100 years ago. And that's the way it can be as we embrace the message of that silent, holy night.
Okay, Boo Boo Bear. Wow. As I studied that event in greater detail, it became obvious that the high command on both sides was not pleased with the fact that the soldiers and their immediate officers decided to unilaterally stop the war. And as we've spoken about on many occasions, this just goes to demonstrate how powerful we really are. Powerful enough to create a miracle.
That's right.
In World War I. What are your thoughts on that, Gigi's book?
Well, I think both of the sides were tired. They knew it was Christmas. They had beliefs. Both sides had beliefs. And it didn't make any difference what their commander said. They stopped it. And they celebrated the best that they could.
Yeah, it's just a fascinating concept to try to envision.
The conditions.
Yeah.
The conditions alone are unreal.
And the fact that after it's all totaled up, 10 million people died. So how do you put those emotions away? How do you put a lid on that?
I don't think you can.
But they seem to manage to do so for a couple of days.
Yeah. Couple of days, and they did well, too.
Oh, yeah. And one of the things you don't hear a lot about is that after the truce, when the high commands ordered the soldiers to begin to fight once more, there were a lot of rifle shots that were either high or low.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't seem to have an interest in killing.
That didn't seem to make the mark, did they?
No, nope. Didn't seem to have an interest in killing each other again. At least not for a while. So, there again, you know, that's how powerful we are. How powerful we can be.
What a wonderful world it would be. We'd all step forth to do that now.
Yeah, Grammy makes a very good point that it's sad that after the brief respite, they go back to fighting because they're ordered to do so. And that conditioning kicks in again. But for a couple of days, they were able to overcome that.
Mm-hmm.
And reestablish,
very touching.
Reestablish their humanity. Okay. Okay, we're halfway through, so maybe we'll just go ahead and push forward. I told you about that article I found in the Wall Street Journal, Gigi's Boo.
Mm-hmm.
I think we have time to go through that real fast.
I think so. Why don't you?
And especially timely, because for most folks out there are familiar with It's a Wonderful Life, probably one of the most popular Christmas movies that has ever been made.
Mm-hmm. My favorite.
And this article is about Jimmy Stewart and how he became George Bailey. And it seems that, many people know that Jimmy Stewart was a bomber pilot in World War II in Europe. And as it turns out, that he had some troubles with those memories. Every year around Christmas, Americans stop to pay homage to what is perhaps our most beloved motion picture, It's a Wonderful Life. The 1946 film may flicker in black and white, but it still manages to feel fresh in affirming the human spirit as we head into each new year. Fans of the movie might assume that making such an uplifting tale was a joy for the cast and crew. In truth, the story of redeeming angels was born in the devastating wake of World War II, and it starred an actor swatting away at his own demons. The first time that Jimmy Stewart appears on screen as George Bailey, the image freezes in close-ups as two angelic figures discuss the character in voiceover. One says to the other, "I want you to take a good look at that face. It's something that all of us should do as we watch the film." Stewart is supposed to be playing a young man in his 20s, but the once boyish 38-year-old had just returned the year before from fighting in Europe, and only makeup and careful lighting would give him a semblance of youth. More seriously, as we know from the testimony of those who worked with him in the military and in Hollywood in those years, Stewart was suffering from what we call today post-traumatic stress disorder. After 2 years of subsisting largely on ice cream and peanut butter, he had only just begun to eat real food and keep it down. He had the shakes and at times flew into rages, and his sleep was interrupted by images of bombers burning in the sky and men tumbling to earth. It's a Wonderful Life was Stewart's first picture after almost 5 years away, including 20 months on the front lines as squadron commander of a B-24 heavy bomber. He flew his first combat mission to Germany on December 13, 1943. He commanded 12 missions in his first 2 months and was almost shot down twice. The experience unnerved him enough that he spent time at the flak farm, where flyers went to decompress after seeing too much combat. It wasn't fear of losing his own life that had gotten to Stewart. It was his deeply ingrained perfectionism, which made him fear making the wrong split-second decision in German airspace while leading dozens of planes and hundreds of men in combat. Filming It's a Wonderful Life found him back in Hollywood after surviving too many crash landings and close calls. In sunny Southern California, the land of make-believe, the suddenly middle-aged man faced other problems. A new crop of youthful leading men had emerged in his absence. He also faced a crisis of conscience, wondering if acting was a worthwhile profession after the gravity of his daily life in the military. This backstory may help explain the remarkable emotional energy of It's a Wonderful Life. Stewart's bordering on frantic performance was not just virtuoso acting. Co-star Donna Reed reported that both Stewart and the picture's director, Frank Capra, made the production difficult at times, as they second-guessed how scenes were done. And why not? Both men were desperate to reestablish themselves in a Hollywood that they feared had passed them while they served in the military. It's a Wonderful Life is considered the picture that relaunched Stewart in a more serious, seasoned actor. But for him, making it was just one more trial by combat. It was the veteran actor Lionel Barrymore, the movie's villain, as you remember, Old Man Potter, helped Stewart to claw his way back. When Stewart wondered aloud during production if acting was worth his time, Barrymore looked him in the eye and asked, "Isn't entertaining people better than dropping bombs on them?" Stuart seems to have gotten the message. He was able to convey great joy and passion in the movie's closing scenes, shouting, "Merry Christmas, Bedford Falls," as he runs through the streets, and saying with a wink to his guardian angel, "Atta boy, Clarence."
Yep. I want to bring something up.
Go ahead.
It goes back to the Cherokee saying, and it's a very powerful saying, that in the heart of every warrior, there is a measure of peace. And I have found that so true with every warrior that I've ever known. They all strive for peace.
Indeed.
They'll fight. They'll fight if they have to. But they do strive for peace.
Indeed, it's so in this next story. Not coincidentally, revolving around a B-17 bomber in World War II and a German ace. The two having a very unlikely encounter. We'll be back after this story.
In the skies over wartime Europe, limping home on a wing and a prayer, and then a change of heart. A mystery that would remain unsolved for decades. W5's Susan Ormiston has a Remembrance Day story you won't soon forget.
Charlie Brown is one lucky man. Flying American bombers in World War II, he could have been another casualty for the 379th Bomb Group.
It's a very beautiful memorial. Quite proud to have been a part of it.
Charlie's life was spared by an enemy. He was Franz Stigler, once an ace flyer, now at 82, mostly grounded.
Once in a while, I took take the controls on it.
Do you miss it?
Very much so.
A lot?
A lot.
During the war, Stigler was on the other side, but in 1953, he left Germany and settled in British Columbia.
So this is your room of honors down here, is it?
Yeah.
He was no average flyer. Stigler was an ace fighter for the German Luftwaffe. At 12, he was flying gliders. By the time war broke out, he was instructing fighter pilots. His combat record, at least 28 enemy aircraft shot down over North Africa and Europe.
Now, what are these here, Franz?
Some of my medals here.
Wow.
This one's for 400 combat missions.
He flew nearly 500 missions, actually, but his most honorable, the time he let the Yankee get away.
This one here, I got because I didn't shoot Charlie down.
A post-war peace medal, awarded by England, because he didn't shoot Charlie down.
That's the only one I'm allowed to wear.
The remarkable story began 5 days before Christmas in 1943. Franz Stigler was a veteran fighter pilot and Charlie Brown on his first mission as commander of a B-17 bomber.
You were a rookie pilot.
Rookie beyond belief.
He even lied about his age. He was 21 but said he was 25 just to impress his crew. Their B-17 was named Ye Olde Pub, part of a 500-bomber formation headed for an airplane factory in Bremen, Germany. They anticipated a dogfight, 250 of Germany's best flak gunners and maybe 500 German fighters.
Once you start on that bomb run, you never divert, you never do anything.
Straight as an arrow.
Just straight to give the lead aircraft time to set up. And that's when the flak is at its most severe.
Ye Olde Pub got hit, her nose blown away. She lost 2 engines, 8 guns, and most of the communications. Still, Charlie and his crew got the bombs off.
And I could not stay in formation even without the bombs. And so the formation just pulled off and left us.
Left by yourself, orphaned.
That's when the Germans showed up.
This time, it was the Luftwaffe's turn to take a bite out of Ye Olde Pub.
I do remember being inverted and looking up at the ground. And the next thing I know, I'm pulling up over trees.
That day in the same battle, Franz Stigler was doing damage in his Messerschmitt 109.
I shot two down in the same day, and then I landed to refuel and rearm.
From the ground, he spotted Charlie Brown's crippled bomber.
So I went after him, looked at the flying wreck and sized him up and figured out how to finish it off.
Had you ever seen a bomber so badly damaged?
Not flying.
Not flying.
Not flying.
So I'm sitting in the cockpit alone, and I look out, and there's the world's worst nightmare sitting on my right wing. I closed my eyes, and I opened them again, and he was still there.
Did you try to shoot at him?
No, I wasn't stupid enough to try to shoot at him.
Why not?
At this point, we're totally helpless.
Shot full of holes, guns frozen up, and a badly wounded crew.
I had one that couldn't walk, one that couldn't use his hands, and one with a leg blown off, and one dead.
Franz had an easy mark. He zeroed in from the rear, expecting to face the tail gunner.
And I saw him lying in there, bleeding profusely, so I couldn't shoot.
You couldn't?
No. If I wouldn't have seen him, it was different. If I wouldn't have seen a person at all, you know, I would have shot.
They're the enemy.
When you shoot at airplane, you don't think of people in there. You see the airplane, nothing else. The plane that bombs your cities or your factories or whatever. But in this case, as I saw this tail gunner, I just couldn't do it.
Instead, he tried to get the B-17 to surrender over Germany, but no response. So he escorted the bomber out over the North Sea and pointed towards Sweden a half hour away. But Charlie Brown had other ideas.
I said, I'm going to try to make England. Well, just about that time, he gave a wave salute and left.
Did you tell anybody about what happened?
No.
Why not?
Well, I didn't want to look in the firing squad.
You would have been court-martialed?
Yes.
For what?
Not doing my job.
Ye old pub made it back to England, a miracle itself, and Charlie Brown had an amazing story to tell, but the higher-ups didn't want to listen.
All aspects of our mission was classified secret.
Why?
Otherwise, we have to mention a German pilot.
So someone decided that it wasn't good PR to show that a German had a heart.
That's right.
Did you ever think of him again?
I always wondered all these years what happened.
The story stays buried for over 40 years until Brown begins a search. Who was that Luftwaffe pilot who let him go?
I tried the American records, of course, absolutely nothing. I had served 3.5 years of the Royal Air Force. They tried to help me. They had absolutely nothing. Nobody had ever heard of a chivalrous German pilot.
After 3 years, a break. A German pilot's newsletter published his article.
All of a sudden, I get this letter from Canada, Surrey, British Columbia. He had markings on my airplane, stuff that I had not put in the article.
They talked by phone, then finally met. Two former enemies, now friends.
Did he thank you?
I don't say he thanked me, just hugged me, but that's it.
He almost broke my ribs. He gave me a big bear hug and whatnot.
Now barely a year goes by without a reunion. This year it's in Savannah, Georgia, at the newly opened 8th Air Force Museum. It stirs the memories.
Now, what was your favorite tail gunner?
Did you get in trouble with some tail gunners, Franz?
Quite often. Yeah.
Oh.
This one is for my tail gunner.
Tail gunner.
Now,
I had one in the lake too for my tail gunner.
Franz, where's your plane?
That one up there. That was my airplane. I lost 17 of them.
Now, did you guys fear the Messerschmitt?
We respected them very much.
So the fact that Franz shot down colleagues, friends...
That was his job.
...family, that doesn't bother you?
No, that was his job. That day... I killed a man who had 70 victories in the Soviet Union. He had a pregnant wife that arrived on the base while he's airborne that day. These things you put in the back and you lock.
Did he ask you why you didn't shoot him down?
No, he didn't. Not then, no. Sometimes I wonder why I didn't.
He's become a pain in the neck, has he?
Yeah. Really.
There's no plane like the 17.
Put any vets together and the stories fly. But this fall, at the reunion of Charlie's 379th Bomb Group, one war tale stood out.
Charlie, would you like to come up here and escort Franz Stigler to the microphone here?
This certificate has been presented to L. Franz Stigler. In appreciation of his compassion and chivalrous action, Franz, it sort of leaves me wordless, almost. It could not happen to a nicer gentleman.
Wow, Boo Boo Bear. And what makes that story even more fantastic than it is the fact that they didn't mention that Franz Stigler's brother had been killed in action just shortly before that encounter. So that made his decision that much more unbelievable.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and based on my timeline here, Boo Boo Bear, we have like 2 minutes of slack.
Two minutes of slack.
Not a whole lot of slack to go. And yes, Graham pointed out, not good PR. No. People always have this tendency of demonizing their enemies, regardless of how true it is or is not. This final story goes to show how powerful a mother can be. Mothers are pretty incredible things, aren't they, Gigi Spoon?
Boy, mine is. I can tell you that.
Well, we can see this mother in World War II and how she took a very explosive situation in hand.
Mm-hmm.
December 1944. The battered German army launched its last great offensive along an 85-mile front in Belgium's Ardennes Forest, the infamous Battle of the Bulge. Nearly 16,000 American soldiers would lose their lives. Another 60,000 would be wounded or captured. It was the costliest battle the United States would wage in any war. Within earshot of the fighting, on the edge of the Ardennes Forest, stood a small, isolated cabin. There, Fritz Vinken, a 12-year-old German boy, lived with his mother, Elizabeth. Fritz's father, Hubert, had moved his family to the cabin for safekeeping. But life in the forest was difficult. While Hubert served as a civilian baker for the German army 20 miles away, Fritz and his mother struggled to put food on the table.
My father thought, like everybody else, that the war would be ended, would be over by Christmas. But it was not to be. And our stay in this shack was longer than we anticipated.
Christmas Eve 1944 arrived with an air of sadness and uncertainty. Hubert has still not returned, and his family was resigned to the fact that they would be spending the holiday without him.
Heute ist Weihnachten. Aber weißt du, wenn kommen könnte, würde bestimmt da sein. Bestimmt.
Fritz's mother tried to make the evening as festive as possible. She scraped together a Christmas meal of a few potatoes and a scrawny rooster.
Papa?
My mother blew out the candle and went to the door, and I went with her. She opened the door, and there were these soldiers.
Ja, bitte?
Good evening, ma'am. Do you speak English?
Nein.
We're Americans.
They tried to talk to us, but my mother didn't speak English.
Our friend's been shot. Can we come inside for a while, please?
My mother just looked, and she looked at the guy sitting in the snow.
Come, Brian.
Thank you.
Until finally my mother, after it seems to be like an eternity to me, she asked him to come in.
Here aufs Bett, da ist es am besten.
Fritz's mother knew full well that harboring the enemy was punishable by death, but she was more than willing to take the risk. The injured soldier had been shot in the leg and had lost a great deal of blood. Elizabeth did her best to make him comfortable.
What is she saying?
I don't know.
Ask her if she speaks French.
Parlez-vous français?
Mais oui. Vous êtes séparé de votre armée?
Oui, madame.
He said that they had lost their unit and were wandering through the Ardennes for the past 2 days and two nights.
Je vais changer les bandages.
She's going to change his bandage.
Fritz, hol doch bitte mal das Tuch, dann reiß ich.
My mother was all motherhood. She worried for them, and she worried for the wounded man, and she did everything she could. They were very nice. Like big boys from the neighborhood, you know.
So how you doing, kid?
Automatically, this must be more Americans. And I went to the door and opened the door. And there were four German soldiers.
Fröhliche Weihnachten.
I was petrified with fear.
Aber wir wurden von unserem Regiment getrennt. Wir haben uns verlaufen.
He said, we have lost our units. And we would like to warm up a little bit.
Sie können auch mit uns zu Abend
essen. So my mother said, you not only
gerne.
Be allowed to warm up, but you get a nice dinner if you accept our guests.
Das für Gäste, Amerikaner etwa?
Ja. Soldaten. Einer davon ist verwundet und ich bin genauso müde wie Sie auch.
And my mother said, this is Christmas night and there will be no shooting around here.
Legt eure Waffen da ab.
Put your arms in the wooden shed and then we come outside and have a nice, nice Christmas.
Das Essen ist schon fast fertig.
Tut, was ich sag. Legt die Waffen auf den Haufen ab und kommt rein. Ich hab Hunger.
Meanwhile, my mother had turned to the Americans, who by then had noticed that some Germans were coming, and had turned to their guns also.
I'll
call you right back.
Je vais les garder. Jusqu'à demain. Merci. Fritz. So, jetzt gehst du noch ein paar Kartoffeln holen.
My mother said to me, get more potatoes and more water. We had more mouth to feed.
Setzen Sie sich doch bitte. Essen ist gleich fertig.
For about a minute or two, maybe three, there was a tension.
Guten Abend. Hello.
But then it was warm, it smelled good, and right away there was a sense of hospitality.
Oh, you speak English?
Yes, a little. Your comrade. He's wounded?
Yeah. He got a round in the thigh earlier.
One of the German soldiers went over to the American that were wounded and asked the Americans in English what was wrong with him.
So what do you think?
He's lucky. He's lost a lot of blood, but the cold has prevented the wound from getting infected. He should recover, provided he gets some rest and nourishment.
Good, good.
He had some first aid kit, and he applied a dressing to the wound. And the whole evening he would every now and then go and look after him.
That night, hostilities ceased in at least one corner of the forest as American and German soldiers sat down together to honor the Christmas spirit.
My mother said grace.
Lieber Herrgott, wir danken dir.
It was not a regular prayer, it was something spontaneous. And she said that let's all thank the Lord for being together tonight peaceful in this terrible war, and let's enjoy dinner, the little things that we have, and let's promise to be friendly to each other forever if possible. Let's also pray for an end of this terrible war so that we all can go home very soon. And by that time they were all crying. Not profusely, but the tears were rolling, you know, even the German sergeant, I was very surprised. And then we ate, and the tears disappeared. But from then on, there was a feeling of friendship that permeated the whole room. It was wonderful. I never forget.
After dinner, the soldiers drifted outside, one by one. Elizabeth and Fritz soon joined them. As they gazed heavenward, each gave thanks in his own way. That night, the men would sleep side by side under the same roof. The differences of war temporarily set aside.
They were so peaceful. You never think that there are two different kind of soldiers that one day before they would have shot each other.
Fritz remembers that the spirit of brotherhood continued the next morning. The German soldiers helped construct a makeshift stretcher for the injured GI and then gave the Americans directions back to their line.
Until you come to the railroad tracks.
Well, that's it for us tonight, Gigi's Boot.
Yes. Just want to tell everybody Merry Christmas again. And be sure to take the road less traveled.
And thanks for joining
us. Love you big to my heart.
And thanks for joining us tonight. Hope you have a great night. We'll see you on New Year's Eve next week on the road less traveled. Bye-bye.